Terry, that's amazing. I gave her that scripture this morning to read 3 minutes before we started worshiping. Wow. Impressive. And a big scripture. But how can you not love the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? First, there's the names. They're so cool. I have a distinct memory when I was young of, in Sunday school, having in our Sunday school papers the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I went home. I was just barely learning to read, and I went over those over and over again until I could just say them that smoothly. And every time I've had somebody to read them as a liturgist, they've kind of risen to the occasion. I know they practice. And Terry, you did a great job. You never want to get the names off, because if you start in the wrong one, it comes out Madrach, She-Cat, and something else. And then the other thing about the furnace is so hot. I mean, that is amazing and huge. As I've grown theologically, I guess, I come to appreciate some other things. You know, in the century before Jesus was born, there was what scholars called a messianic expectation. Usually we go back in scripture and look at the ancient prophets, but they were always talking about a real king who was really about to be born when Isaiah and the others we speak of. We don't know exactly when or how the expectation of a Christ, another aspect of God, came into being. But this scripture that comes to us, well, not from Nebuchadnezzar's time. It actually was written much later, maybe only 100, 120 years before Christ. And this is one of the few hints we have of a messianic expectation, an expectation of a Christ in that fourth figure. That's exciting to me. There's some question exactly where that all comes from. But there was also in this scripture a new kind of literature. You know, we know that in Hebrew scriptures we have the prophets and we have the law. And we have wisdom literature, Job and Jonah. But this was a new kind, something called apocalyptic. It was written for terrible times, when you have huge tyrannic peoples and groups. And it was too dangerous to name the tyrant at the time. So they used an old name, Nebuchadnezzar. But it was Antiochus Epiphanes, in fact, they were talking about, because he really did some of the very things that are mentioned in the story. He built a huge gold figure of himself and wanted everybody to bow down to it, and they wouldn't. So the thing with apocalyptic literature is that it uses such large and powerful images. Sometimes I think we don't see ourselves in it so much. So I decided to look at this in a more common way. I want to talk about something I learned at camp. Two little stories. Well, one's a big story. First of all, how I ended up at camp. It was a few months before my 22nd birthday. I was about to graduate from college. I was at the University of Illinois. I was scheduled to start seminary in the fall at Iliff School of Theology here in Denver. And it occurred to me as a 22-year-old that I had spent nearly a third of my life working in men's clothing stores. That's weird, isn't it? I mean, selling double-breasted suits and jockey briefs and Florsheim wingtips. And it seemed to me, before I went to seminary, I should do something a little more humanistic. So I prayed about it, and I said, I should be a camp counselor. But there was a problem. Camp counseling didn't pay very much, And I needed to make enough money over the summer and save it to pay for a year's tuition in seminary. I went to a job search and quickly found out that the churches and the Y's do not pay that well. So I kept looking. I went to a checked into a private camp. At some point in the application process, I realized that there were two very great issues that might disqualify me. For one, it was a sports camp, and I didn't have a sport. The other was that it was a Jewish camp for boys, and I was about to go to theological seminary. I thought, well, if I get this job, it's Jesus. It's got to be Jesus. The cheer for the camp was, Izzy, Ikey, Jakey, Sam, we're the boys who eat no ham. And on Sundays, we got to sleep in, and we had lox, bagels, and cream cheese, which the boys assured me that in their culture, is exactly what you're supposed to do on Sundays. I was a counselor in the youngest cabin, 8 and 9 year olds. And the other thing I discovered that I didn't know when I applied was that you'd have the same kids for 8 weeks. 8 weeks, 8 and 9 year old kids away from their families. I thought that was pretty wild. There was one time in the middle of the camp session after the fourth Saturday, parents came. It was Parents' Day. They come for 4 hours. You had to be there on time, and everybody came. I had never seen so many BMWs and Mercedes in my life, I didn't even know that they made a Jaguar big car, you know. But I found that out at those at the camp. And when the parents left, though, oh boy, the long faces, the sobbing. It was rough. It was rough. That was the moms. The boys were even worse. I mean, we had a bunch of fun things planned to get their minds off the fact that their parents were gone. And the worst was at dusk. Right at dusk, we'd go down to the lake, and they had a nude swim. It was the silliest thing I've ever seen. All the splashing and crazy. And you know, Wisconsin has the biggest mosquitoes in the world. And we were in northern Wisconsin. So after all the foolishness and the stuff, we were back in our cabin, and the pall of homesickness was so deep, you could just feel it. Well, talking wasn't allowed after lights out, and after the kids were in and lights were out. Suddenly I heard out of the gloom a tiny voice, I wish I had my stuffy. Another voice, yeah, my lion. You know, there are no stuffies in class, or not at camp. Your pastor would probably challenge the idea and say, why not stuffies at camp? But there were no stuffies at camp. One of the kids then said, I want my stuffy, the lion. And then somebody said, yeah, I have a stuffy lion with the David. And then another one said, yeah, I have the stuffy and David too with my lion. And they all turned out to have lions for stuffies. That was a part of their culture. It was part of their story. They all knew about Daniel and the lion's den, this book of Daniel. And they began to talk. And suddenly they were not just a group of boys who eat no ham, but they were boys who had left their stuffies behind at one of the saddest times in their lives. And they found a community. They gathered around not the stuffies, but the story behind the stuffies, the story of God's faithfulness, the God's protection. The boys went to sleep, but I was amazed. My theological education began that night at camp when a group of homesick 8-year-olds taught me that a great story can be the source of resilience and courage. The courage that Daniel had and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego showed was not just any courage, of course. It was a moral courage, a courage to stand up for God in faith and conviction. We can memorize commandments that say we have no other gods before us, but when we have the story of those three friends who'll sing hymns to God in a fiery furnace rather than bow their heads before the golden image of a tyrant, that's where courage is, and the fortitude to choose the hard and the less comfortable kind over the easy, selfish, or uncaring. Faith travels on its stories. The stories we tell about God and about ourselves make a difference in our lives. If we believe that God is always judging us and out to catch us doing something bad, well, that's going to affect how we live our lives. If we think of God as ready to punish, well, it may affect us for good, but sometimes can be pretty awful. If we believe that the story of God is a story of one who loves us and favors us over other folks, well, that will change the way we think too. And it may affect how we treat other people. If we believe in a God who loves all, then that will affect how we act too. There's an old story. Actually, I want to go back. Harry Emerson Fosdick, great preacher of the last century. I don't know if you have heard of Fosdick, some of them. In the 1920s, so 100 years ago, he was kicked out of the Presbyterian Church. They said he was too modernistic. He actually kind of believed in evolution and things like that. And it's too modernist. And so we somebody said, let's open our own church in New York City. It became the largest Protestant church in America. He became the biggest and had the biggest audience over the radio in the golden age of radio. Somebody came to him once, a young pastor, who was having kind of problems with this church and said, it just seems like I'm not getting the results I want. People aren't having their lives change, aren't, trusting God like I hoped. So he was asking for help from Fosdick. And Fosdick said to him, well, you don't expect that every week people are going to have their lives changed and strangely warmed, as the Methodists say. And the fellow said, well, no, not every week. And he said, that's the problem. you need to believe that it can happen. You need to believe that that's what we're here doing. Sarah tells me that last week you all voted to take on a great undertaking, to invest in your building, to better serve children and your community, to make yourselves more accessible, to be more open to people. That is a great expectation. When she told me your results, I was just overwhelmed. I'm so excited for you because it's a great thing that you're doing. So I believe that knowing your story now, that it's going to happen and it's going to be great. You are living into that story. I have another. Then a second story about what I learned at camp. Not only the power of story, but second year I went, I did go 2 years, which is why I tell people that some nice Jewish families in Chicago subsidized the first 2 years of my seminary. And they did. So the first day, the boys got on a bus in Chicago, arrived several hours later at the camp in northern Wisconsin. Actually, the grounds had originally belonged to the Comiskey family. It was the training center for the Chicago White Sox until they discovered that 40 miles south of Lake Superior is probably not a great place to do spring training. Go figure. So the kids are arriving. They've come up from Chicago. They're getting off the bus. We counselors are looking over the kids and saying, I wonder what it's going to be like. These are the kids we're going to be with for 8 weeks. And I looked at two of them and said, yeah, these two are going to do okay. They've got a lot of confidence, and they may be leaders. They seem to be a little alpha-like. And there were two who kind of looked like they were going to be bullied a bit and probably have some people making fun of them. And sure enough, before they'd even picked out their beds, one of those stronger kids looked at one of the weaker ones and nudged the other of the stronger kids. They'd already found each other, nudged him and said something mean. I don't remember exactly what it said, but he was looking for some agreement from the other boy. And he paused quietly. It was loud enough that everybody in the cabin heard it. And this other boy said, you know, I was hoping camp wouldn't be like that. And you know what? Camp wasn't like that for 8 weeks. Sometimes the guy inclined to bully would try something, but it never got any traction. Because whatever that hope was that that boy had, that he expressed, I was hoping just that camp wouldn't be like that, changed them. It gave them something, that they weren't gonna be that way, because none of them wanted camp to be like that. What I learned at camp is that we don't have to be mean to each other, and we don't have to let meanness and bullying be the center of our lives. We have other options. Jesus teaches us those other options. They were no longer kids who eat no ham. They were kids who trusted and cared about each other. In the days that followed, I learned that there were even more vulnerable kids in that group than the first two identified. But there was safety there. These are good words for us to live in a time when fear and dominance and intimidation and vengeance are in our public discourse. We don't have to be like that. Life doesn't have to be like that. Church doesn't have to be like that. Thanks be to God.